Welcome to Changemaker with founder of Gypsy Tea and social entrepreneur Zina Muzika.
This new podcast is to help you embrace change and experience amazing people and entrepreneurs. We're going to be sharing secrets, habits, and change-making abilities with you so that you can apply them to your life and make a life of your dreams.
This is Changemaker with Zina Muzika.
Hey, Changemakers. Thank you for joining us for today's podcast. I'm Zina Muzika, your host. Today, we are with Iram Parveen Bilal. She is a filmmaker, and she was raised in Nigeria and Pakistan, and she is a physics Olympian turned filmmaker. She just directed her second feature film, the PhD movie, Return to Grad School. Her first feature, Josh, a 2012 Women in Film awardee, enjoyed theatrical and ancillary distribution success in multiple territories. Bilal is the initiator and current member of the Pakistani Oscar Committee and is also the founder of Pakistan's first professional screenwriting lab. And her alma mater is Caltech and USC. So, Iram, just a little impressive there, not to be intimidating or anything, right?
Well, I don't know if degrees and awards, I mean, we just have to put these bios together just to, you know, apply the things. But
frankly, my bio is obnoxious. My publicist wrote it, and I was doing a keynote last week at an all-women's college in Omaha, and they were reading the bio, and I was so embarrassed. I was like, this is, like, really braggy.
It's always like that when they do it in an intro, and you're just like, oh, can you please stop? But it's like, you know, I mean, they want people to have a quick crash course at your shell, but that doesn't get to the heart of anything, right?
So. Totally. Well, let's get to the heart of things. You are obviously a change maker. You know, you grew up in Nigeria and Pakistan. You are a Pakistani female filmmaker. I mean, I don't know. Do you know how many there are out of Pakistan?
You know, you'd be surprised, actually. Most there is a higher percentage of Pakistani filmmakers who are women compared to female filmmakers from India. I don't know what it is. I think it's just the indie film movement, but a lot of the women are the ones who are actually driving change and making films. So
wonderful. So let's talk about Josh. Let's talk about your first film. That is, you mentioned we met at a dinner of high-achieving women at Shiza's house. Shiza Shahid, who's been a guest on the podcast, and she's a change maker. And we were all sitting around talking about the things that, you know, matter most to us. And I think what struck me was when you were talking about just this unexpected ride with this film and how it was able to create change. And then the Smithsonian chose it. Tell me a little bit about what happened with the film, why you decided to make it, and the journey it took you on.
I mean, I definitely wanted to make my first film in Pakistan, even though I have you know, ties to the U.S. as well. I felt that we were not hearing enough of a narrative from that country. I mean, you were listening to the news, and you were reading the headlines, but you weren't really getting the story of the people on the ground. So it had to be my first feature, and that was sort of how it happened. And then I was on this project on Benazir Bhutto, the prime minister was assassinated. We were doing a documentary for her, and, you know, we were doing a section of the real true heroes of Pakistan. And this woman, Parveen Saeed, was interviewed, and, you know, she's a woman who decided to quit her career as a nurse because she saw a woman kill her two kids and then kill herself because she couldn't feed them. And so she made it her lifelong struggle to erase hunger. And, you know, so there's dialogues in the film, erase hunger to erase crime, because Parveen feels that people at the end of the day just want to feed their kids, and that's why they do what they do.
I 100% agree. I 100% agree.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I may or may not fully agree with that, just because I do think that there are people also who have a vested interest in, you know, more than that in terms of being, you know, committing crimes. But I did fully believe, I mean, she just looks at the camera and says, all I'm asking you is for a fistful of flour from your kitchen. Can you do that for me? And it's like, how do you say no to something like that, right?
Wow.
And so she burned a hole in my mind. And the next time I was visiting Pakistan, I was like, I need to meet this woman. You know, I was taking some charity for family and stuff to her kitchen. And a friend of mine was like, let's do a documentary on her. And I was like, you know what? I'm just done with documentaries about Pakistan. It's like, you know, it's like everyone, when you introduce yourself as a filmmaker from Pakistan, people presume you're a documentarian because there's so many issues, you know, in the country. And I feel like there are issues everywhere in the world, and there's a way to cinematically show them. And so that was the genesis of Josh, and I decided to, you know, tie up with her food kitchen. And there's a lot of other themes of, like, youth movement and the Pakistani Spring and feudalism and all of that. At the heart of it, it's also about food and the necessity of food and what how that drives people to desperation of evil and goodness.
So tell me what you learned. So you grew up in Nigeria and Pakistan, and you had a particular view of the world, and then you came to the U.S. and went to school. Tell me about what it was like to be raised in Pakistan and then leave and look back at it from a Western point of view, because what we hear on the news here, you know, it's just the country's a mess and it's warring and the, you know, the bombers and it in the Taliban. I mean, it's just like we don't hear much that's right with the country. And when I've traveled, I've been to Lahore, I've been to Pakistan, and I've been to India a lot. When I watch the news from there, I see a completely different story. I see the positive things that are happening. I see, you know, the peace, the peace efforts. They talk about what's right with the country. We just don't get a taste of that here. What was that like for you to experience?
I think, Zina, I mean, truth, it's really hard to find what truth is in today's world. Like, truth in any way, I often say this, truth is perception. I mean, it's like the uncertainty principle in physics and quantum physics. It's like when you, the moment you observe something, you change its position, right?
And absolutely.
That's exactly, I think, how the news is, too. So actually, when I'm in, you know, even I, who've grown up in Pakistan, sometimes if I'm, like, listening to the news a lot in the U.S., I'm like scared to visit if I've got a trip coming up, right? And then you're sitting there in your cozy home and you're smelling the, you know, freshly made chapatis and going out and eating with friends and, you know, laughing and having mehndi put on your hands. And, you know, it's so different. So it's all about perspective and point of view. Now, that being said, it's not that, you know, the red line news items are not happening. Maybe not to the extent that, you know, they're being reported, and maybe all the positive stories are not being reported. But, you know, there were shootings in the school in Peshawar. Things are hitting closer to home now. You know, for me, my friends who are journalists are leaving the country. So there is definitely, I feel that, but when I'm on the ground, all I can think about is connecting and giving and sharing and receiving. And there's so much optimism. I mean, there's frustration as well because the instability and the politics are trickling down to the basic survival of people now. So when I came here, I definitely did feel like people viewed me. And, you know, I came here a year to the date before September 11th.
Wow.
I landed in Pasadena, California, which couldn't be more different
from
Islamabad, Pakistan, except that, you know, you have those gorgeous Margola Hills, and now you have, like, the St. Gabriel Mountains. But other than that, I mean, there was nothing similar, right? And, you know, people looked at me in 2000, they didn't even know what Pakistan were. They were like, oh, is it a city in Iowa? Because I sounded American for some reason. I have a thing with accents. But, you know, after September 11th, suddenly everyone knew Pakistan. And for, as far as I knew, they knew it for the wrong reasons, you know, because now it was like, oh, Pakistan. And the next question was, what do you think about the politics? And it was never about, like, you know, people will be like, oh, you speak such good English. And it's like, well, what does that mean? I mean, there's a lot of people who speak really good English, you know. So it's been, and looking back at the country, I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, I mean, there's no argument to the patriarchy in our culture, you know, and I often felt it even when I was there. But, you know, being here and then going back, I do feel that, you know, as a woman, like, maybe I'm not as, you know, you're respected in a motherly sense. For the fact that you have the quality of being a mother, and I think that that is the most appreciated thing, really. I feel like as professional women, women are respecting other women, but I still think men have a long way to go. I'm generalizing here, but you know, women have a very far off journey right now, and men have a long way to go to actually start respecting them as, you know, career women. So I definitely feel that when I go back, but I'm in an interesting position because I'm often also, like, trying to, you know, explain the case of America when I'm in Pakistan, and I'm often trying to explain the case of Pakistan when I'm
got it.
In America when I'm in Pakistan. So Yeah, I'm truly now a global citizen, and I guess my truths are all warped.
Well, so tell me, so what was it like to go back and shoot a film? You know, it's beautifully, beautifully shot, and you know, the acting is great. I mean, it's just a beautiful, you know, in all transparency, I only got halfway through it, but it's actually, the DVD is in my laptop right now, and I'm going to finish it as soon as we jump off here. But and it's also available on Netflix, and I put it in my queue there. But tell me about the making of the film and what you learned about yourself and the miracle. You talked about a miracle that came from it.
Yeah. It's also, just before we go ahead, it's also available on iTunes and Amazon, and it would be great if you watch it and you like it, you give us a review.
And it's spelled Josh, J-O-S-H.
It's spelled Josh, spelled like Josh.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kept the name even though people call it Josh because it helps people remember.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, I think shooting a film on a limited budget is hectic, no matter where you are, and I think it was even more hectic because... the infrastructure of film really is not there in Pakistan. I mean, you know, just the idea of renting cameras and, like, the right lighting equipment and, you know, doing sync sound. We're still pretty foreign when we shot this in 2011 because people dub films. I mean, they do they ad-lib. So they don't really record sound as they're recording pictures. So the idea of being quiet on set or holding the mic the right way or, you know, there were a lot of basics. But that was part of the mission of the film, was to drive change in the industry, which is why I made my first film there. I mean, the film I'm about to make now was actually my first script before Josh, but I very intentionally wanted to do that because I wanted to help crystallize movement in the industry. And it did happen. We worked with media students. We were there 3 months ahead of time. We were teaching people to transfer data, AD, all of that. And most people who worked on this film, it was their first ever feature. And then after our film, they went on to work on multiple features. So I remember the red camera we were shooting with it celebrated its first ever 100 cards on our set because it was only used to film commercials. It had never done long form content. So, you know, it was as hard as it was because it was a new industry. It was amazing because people were so excited, you know, to be on the film. And now that I look back at it, having directed my second feature just recently, also a small budget, but here in the US, you know, they did really well for not having any film knowledge, frankly. Mm-hmm. So I was very happy, and it was, you know, I would be suddenly pinching myself when we would be at 2 a.m. in a not very safe village 2 hours out of Karachi, and, you know, here I am calling action and cut and these actors, and it's a beautiful starlit night, and I would really stop and absorb the moment and be like, I cannot believe this is happening.
Like,
I need to stop and celebrate right now, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, the film, like, it had its festival premieres, distribution, and the miracle I was going to talk to you about was, you remember I told you it was based on the woman who started the food kitchens. Well, part of the proceeds of the film were going to the food kitchen, and, you know, it raised the profile.
Tell us about the food kitchen.
So this woman, Pareen Saeed, is amazing, and you can I'll probably link it to my interview, but it's Khanagar, khanagar.org, which means food kitchen. And she basically has opened up food kitchens where she does not provide food for free, but subsidized, because she doesn't want to just give charity. She wants people to be incentivized to still buy their food. But, like, you can buy, like, a meal for 3 rupees today, which is, like, 3 cents. And so for 3 cents, you know, you can buy a meal that has reasonable nutrition and protein and stuff in her food kitchens. And she runs, I think there's 3 or 4 brick and mortar ones and a few more where she just, it's like food distribution in and around Karachi, because she feels that, you know, but there's so much poverty that even she says that sometimes she's stoned on her way to opening the food kitchen because people are so upset. Like, all they see is their need.
Yeah.
And so they don't see this person as a provider. They're just upset that she did not feed them the day before. And she's like, well, we only had so much, you know. This is Pareen Appa. And so as the film was, you know, touring, you know, we were going on talk shows in Pakistan when the film released in August 2013. It was around Eid. And it so happened that in May earlier that year, the film had screened in Melbourne. And this man was like, absolutely moved by the film. So he decided to do a fundraiser for the food kitchen after the viewing of the film. And, mashallah, they were able to raise enough money to feed 140 families for the entire month of Ramadan. And when I heard that, you know, I was so humbled. I was in Karachi. And at that point, the money had come through and the food had been purchased. And I didn't know all of this, but, you know, Parveen Appa called me and she said, Iram, I want you to hand out the bags. And, you know, I was, like, running around trying to just, you know, marketing and talk show appearances and stuff. And part of the town where it was a little dangerous. My mom was like, oh, you know, don't go. And I was like, how can I not go? I mean, how can I not go? I mean, there's movies about this woman. Like, I'm not going to not go. And so I, you know, convinced a few friends of mine and we drove. And we are there and we're standing in this, like, you know, little storage area, at this room and this sort of sink gate. And she, like, you know, meets me and there's a couple of pictures and she gives me, like, this really nice, like, bottle of Fanta and I'm drinking it. And then she, like, pulls up the zinc gate, right? And, you know, there's, like, a line around the block of women with niqab, like, fully face covered. And they're, like, coming towards me like a stampede and, like, just ripping these, like, at first I just see that. And they're just all coming towards me, and I just turn around. I told Parveen, I was like, I need a minute. And I was just so humbled and grateful and moved. Here, you know, I could not believe that, you know, some dialogues I wrote in a cafe in Pasadena were translating into physical grains of nutrition and food that was going to go into the mouths of these babies, of these women who don't know who I am, who don't care who I am. And that's the power of art, right? I was so humbled to know, like, very few artists get to see that so directly in their life.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely.
I was so humbled. I was crying, and, like, you'll see it in the video that I get. My eyes are watery, and basically, I just turned around, and I was just giving these bags, and, you know, they were just ripping them. They didn't care who I was, and why should they? I mean, it was like a symbol. I'm just like a vessel, and
so
that
what
was, like, truly.
What goes through what? So I had a similar experience. Just traveling to India so much for the tea company and for work, and I always felt like, oh my God, how will we even make a dent on how much poverty there is? I mean, the things that I saw, and when people say, oh, I want to go to India and learn to meditate, and I'm like, it's great. It's not all eat, pray, love. It's really it's all of humanity in its rawest sense, everywhere in Technicolor, and it's so intense. And so how do you, I mean, it sounds like through art, through your film, you were able to touch 140 families for a month, but what do you think the real answer is? Long-term, big sweeping, you know, impact? What, you know, you're a global citizen. You're looking at things from the lens of somebody who's lived in many countries. And as a filmmaker, what do you think we can do to actually make change?
You know, it's a very good question, because I took a seat back after Joshin. You know, I went from science to film because I wanted to make an impact, right? And then you often question, you're like, well, what impact? You know, when those kids were killed in Peshawar, I was so depressed. I was crying.
God.
And I said, you know, what's the point? I'm so helpless. You know, there's nothing I can do that is going to stop these beasts. And, you know, tons of my, you know, friends and fans were just like, no, you must keep putting the message out there. And I think that the reason, first, just to go back to, like, filmmaking, is the reason I think I'm continuing is because there's something to thought provocation, and there's something to showing all of us that we are similar and we are the same. And I know it seems slow and inefficient, but, you know, it is a step towards that sort of a progress. On a bigger global sense, I think that as artists, we need to not just engage through our products, you know, whether it's tea or film. Like, I think we need to actively go out there, speak, engage, serve as much as we can. Because, see, you know, it's not that we're going to stop and try and become politicians.
No.
And it's not that politicians are the only ones who can drive change. I think no matter who you are, you're right, it's a dent. But I think, A, by inspiring as many people as you can, if you can, like, create the tiny dent to be, like, 1,000-fold, then the dent starts meaning something, you know, or 100,000-fold. So it's all about cultivating your reach and then really really driving home that message that you want to do with your art.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
You're listening to Changemaker with Zena Muzyka.
I'm on a vein here and I want to go deep because I have a daughter. She's five, and I've been really affected by what's happening in Asia, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Thailand. I mean, all the entire part of the world with child brides and girls not having access to education. And then the, you know, I have a friend who has a nonprofit in Nepal, and I've been working with them. And basically, he says that this man, this good-looking man in a suit, will show up in a village and say, "Oh, I have work for your daughter," or "I'd like to have your daughter's hand in marriage." And then the family is so poor that they are, and they're grateful because they can barely feed this daughter. And so they say, "Okay, sure, you know, take her. Oh God, what great fortune." And then she ends up in a brothel in, you know, Mumbai or something. So what I've been sickened by it for a long time and trying to figure out what I can do. And so this morning, you know, I saw something yesterday on Facebook, and I've got this five-year-old girl who, I mean, at this age, things are happening like this. And she is so precious and so tiny and so vulnerable. And I thought, what can I do? I've been like literally feeling like I'm getting an ulcer over it for the last week. I saw something on Facebook that triggered it a week ago. And then so I went online and I adopted a girl in New Delhi through Apne App. For like $160, I could help get a girl out of sexual slavery. And then I thought, okay, well, there's one. But $160, like, I need to multiply that by, you know, a good 4 or 5 or 10 million times $160 to change this. I mean, as a filmmaker, you know, I mean, I don't know what else to do other than just try to affect one person positively. But you creating media, you could affect things so big. And mm-hmm. you know, so what do you see in that? In, you know, because it is really the age where we have got to stop abusing women and girls. This is, you know, we have got to unite and end this violence and rape. And I mean, it's got to change now. As a mother of a daughter, as a woman myself, as, you know, an advocate for women, what do you see that we can do along these lines?
Well, I mean, I think that something, the people that are most important in this conversation are the perpetrators. And so really, I think also raising sons to understand, to respect women and view them differently is a huge part of the deal. And I think that all the sort of female-driven heroes and female-driven like media that is becoming like a buzzword now and is becoming, you know, there's an attention towards creating strong roles for women. There's an NGO called Femme Inc. that specifically does, like, you know, it studies what type of media you watch or, like, what you watch and how it affects you. And I think that type of media is, and it's specifically towards how people view women. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a responsibility of, in terms of the content you put out there and what type of role models you're showing girls in terms of hope. But B, it's also, It is about the poverty, right? Because at the end of the day, these parents are desperate, which is why they give the girls away, right? Or like in your book, you were talking about the child, you know, the children, and you know how the fact that like when they banned child labor, the kids actually lost their jobs, and you know a lot of people have kids just so that they can be exchanged for money or that they can go and work and bring money, and so that has to do so much with, again, education. And because if there is education, because poverty is because there's a lot of lack of family planning and lack of a realization of, you know, how you're going to provide for your kids. So, I mean, there's a multi-level. There's on one level, it's content creation. On another level, it's active engagement and tying social action with your projects and with your films. And then you try and do your part. I mean, one alone cannot change the world, but one alone can inspire others and can inspire others and can inspire others till it becomes the world. So to answer your question, I think we just, every day of our life, make a positive, proactive effort to change, to speak out. You know, social media has been great. You're able to affect so many people. I mean, so many people know a different Pakistan just because they're friends with me and they see me sharing news articles and, you know, other images of Pakistan that they're getting from the news. So, I mean, as a single person, the way you really multiply it is by the type of content you create and how you push it out there. And then you continue to do the positive work you do. And I guess you just, for every bad news you get, you go out there and, you know, do something like you did. And you tell other people and you inspire other people. There's always going to be evil in this world. There's always going to be good in this world. And we can only, like, identify what is what by the existence of the other.
Well, and as a filmmaker and a global citizen, you have a lens on how to actually illuminate, like, even just the way you shot Josh, the way you showed the fishermen, the way you showed the industrial area, you know, just the opening shots, I was transported. I was there. And it gave me, even though I've only been to Lahore, but it gave me a sense of place. And I think that if we can create through art a sense of place and transport people to that, to the fact, you know, where they can have a cathartic shift, you know, a visceral shift in their senses, you know, I think also with these girls that are out in, you know, this part of the world who are having a lack of education. I mean, now we have Malala, we have a spokeswoman. And how has, you know, I know that you are in, you know, Malala, and how has that shifted things in Pakistan, you feel? Because we see Malala from here, from a Western point of view, and we're all celebrating her and thrilled. And I'm a contributor to the Malala Fund. And, you know, what is it like from the point of view in Pakistan with Malala? How has she changed things?
I mean, honestly, on the ground level, I don't think it really changes much more than what obviously the Malala Fund is doing. People also have negative feelings, you know, about her just because, you know, there's all these conspiracy theories. There always are conspiracy theories. And, you know, people, it's really sad to me because people will talk about how, you know, oh, you know, but she's getting a Nobel Prize, but that's like shining a light on something negative in terms of the fact that, like, you know, so much violence happened in Pakistan. And I was like, well, then let's not do the violence, you know. I agree, but, you know, here's also, like, a child who has been really strong and is speaking for the right things. And if you don't want, you know, the negative things to be highlighted, then let's stop doing the negative things. I frankly don't know and don't think there has been that much impact yet on the ground, like, just because there's such a negative backlash. But it doesn't matter because of the negative light, because I'm sure that the girls who are watching her, who are her age, you know, there is a shift of strength in them. And that's what, I mean, I think the change has to come in the thoughts and hearts of people. It might not be measurable to the normal eye, but there's a shift, you know, and that's what's beautiful about filmmaking. It's like at a time, 300 people in a theater, if you're lucky for a theatrical, you know, they're watching and shifting their opinion and their view.
It's like, so transformational.
For example, Josh.
I believe film is one of the few mediums that we can actually have a complete transformation in a 2 or 3 hour period.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, now, like with Josh, around 200,000 people have seen Pakistan, and maybe, like, I don't know, 50,000 of them are non-Pakistanis who have now seen, like, a different, you know, it's the only film in the Library of Congress's permanent selection. It's been archived in their permanent selection. So it's there's a narrative, but just like you, I'm also very unsettled. Like, I'm always very unsettled, and I always feel like I need to do more. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I also, like, I mean, if you just go into an existential debate, I do feel like we as human beings are made to self-exterminate ourselves. So I think, I really, truly believe, I mean, you know,
I can't believe we're laughing at that.
But it's true. I mean, because we are so crazy about survival, right? So at the end of the day, I do feel that we're going to just all, you know, create havoc for ourselves.
Well, where does spirituality play into your life and your work? Do you have a practice? Because for me, I think I would self-exterminate if I didn't have my meditation practice. I think I would probably have imploded by now. What do you do? Because you're obviously very busy.
I've been raised in a Muslim household, and there's still a lot of things I practice, but yeah, I just really, I think my parents have raised me with such a solid set of morals, and I've come from a culture that is so much about sharing and giving that, you know, that is a part of me. Like, you know, I'm so connected to my family and my close friends, and I'm so connected, like at the bottom, I like to think I'm a good person. So yeah, if I see something wrong happening to, there's no way, whether I have the money or I don't, that I'm not going to give to it, right?
Yeah.
But day to day, I mean, like, I definitely pray. I do yoga. I love staying connected with my artist friends and my scientist friends. They really bring a balance to my life. But really, I mean, yeah, I think it's just every single day taking a moment. I'm living a life of dreams. You know, sure, it doesn't have the finances that I could have if I continued as an engineer, but who gets to sit, you know, get up in the morning and create their schedule and write and watch films as research? Like, I'll go to movies, and you know, I can expense that because and that's crazy, you know. So the life I lead is like, I mean, I'm grateful for it every day, which is why I work so hard, because I don't know when it's going to change, you know.
But let's talk about that.
I'm trying to be grateful.
So you were on a track to be an engineer. You went to Caltech, and so when you decided I'm going to be a filmmaker, did that take a tremendous amount of courage? Because I have a lot of friends who want to write full time, but who have day jobs, or who want to be filmmakers and you know, but can't raise the money. You know, tell me a little bit about how you shifted, or when you knew that you were going to shift course and become a filmmaker.
I think a lot of it is also intrinsically that I'm a very, very determined and strong-headed person. Like, if I put my mind to something, like, I am going to do it. There's just nothing, like, I'm not okay with accepting failure. And, you know, I just have very strict goals for myself. So, but also a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was 21, and it was way easier to make a change then, you know?
No kids yet, no overhead.
Yeah, no kids. So, you know, I just realized I loved science. I was good at it, but I was just not as crazy as the people around me. And so Caltech is good in the fact that it's such cutting edge. Like, it's a cutting edge playground, right? It's a sandbox for some of the best minds in the world for science and math. And so you're like, well, this is a good showing of the fact that if I'm not feeling it here, like, I'm not going to be able to work. If I can't work to be the best at what I do, like, if I don't feel like I have that drive, I'm not going to do it, right? So I'd grown up on Bollywood. I love film. And I did a couple of, like, these grants that Caltech offered for people at crossroads with science. And I was at University of Sussex between junior and senior year, and I did a digital production class, and I loved it. And I sort of just applied to USC Film School. I really didn't think they would take me. I applied to UCLA as well, and I got rejected, but USC took me. And that's sort of how, I think, like, being raised in an Asian family, I think it was important that I got into a program, because I don't know if I would have just, like, continued in film had I not gotten into a degree program. Just because it's just the way we think. We're very structured like that. And then, honestly, to answer your question, like, there were a lot of times when, you know, my then boyfriend, now husband, would always ask me, he's like, well, do you have a deadline? Like, how long are you going to do this? Like, if it doesn't work till, like, next year.
Which I think our audience needs to know, you're this beautiful Pakistani powerhouse, and you're married to a Texan in a pickup truck.
he's amazing. He's my anchor. He's my grounding. He would never be the one to ask. But then there would be times when he would see me crying and fighting with the fact that, am I ever going to make a film? Am I going to make a feature film? And you know, my mom, like, rightfully so, was like, babe, what are you going into, honey? Like, you don't have money, and we're not, like, she said, it's all about who you know and how rich you are. And she said, we're not rich. and you don't know anyone in this field. And my mom was like, you've gone to such a good school, and you know, film is not a meritocracy. Sadly, it's not. And so, I mean, there were a lot of those moments, I would say, like the first 3-4 years were really tough out of film school. And then when I decided to put my mind on Josh, I think that was the biggest thing. I was working as an editor on a documentary for Puto, and, you know, I just decided I was going to do this. I wrote. I used to wake up at 5, write, then go to work, then come back, and then tutor at night. And then from all the money I would make from tutoring, I started, you know, buying a flight to. I started trying to, like, email people, and nobody was really responding. Then I just showed up at their door, and that's how I started raising money. Literally was just asking people who were the rich people they knew. And it took a year and a half to get to the right people. Like, it was just, it took so much more time than I'm hoping it will take for the next project, because now, you know, because I set 4-wall theaters and traveled with the film, like, what I didn't expect was I also was sort of building a potential investor audience, because at every event, when people would hear about how hard it was, they came up to me and they were like, you know, next time you're making a movie, come to me.
Yeah.
Which was just manifested last week, because I went to Houston and those people were amazing, and I went back to them. I took notes. And so I was like, well, you told me I should come to you when I'm doing my next film. And they were like, oh, you remembered. And, you know, they totally stood up by their promise. And I'm hoping that, you know, it's going to
be easier. Well, I think what you said is exactly right. You decided, and that set the course into action, even though you didn't. Like, I had $6 the day I started the tea company, but I decided I was going to do it. But then also you said something else that I want our listeners to take note on is that even if somebody is saying no to fund something at the time, if they see you actively out there making things happen, they will come back around. And I raised...
Yeah. I often say that no are 2 letters and negotiate.
That's a great one. I love that.
And it's so true. Like, the person who ended up taking 55% of the stakes of Josh.
Yeah, he
called me. Like, I was on phone with him for 6 months. He was in between Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and then LA. And he was all, and I told him, I said, you literally, and I had kept money aside for this. I said, if you can tell me when you are in Pakistan, like, I will fly out. I just need 15 minutes of one-on-one with you. And I kept at it for 6 months. Finally, I was able to actually go to his house. I was in Karachi, and he was there. And I said, I need to see you. And I took a rickshaw. I didn't even, like, my sister was just, she had just given birth, and there was no car to take me. The family was busy, and I took a rickshaw straight to his house. It was, like, palatial house. Nobody goes in rickshaws in these areas, right? Everyone has drivers and cars. And I went and I pitched to him. And in the middle of my pitch, he just committed 2 units. And those were the first units, the shares I had sold. And he hadn't even, like, listened. He was just staring at me. He was not even listening to what I was saying.
Well,
and he didn't care. Because
I agree.
Yeah, I agree.
The
investors don't invest in projects. They invest in people.
Exactly. I agree.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Changemaker with Zina Muzyka.
To just give, like, some thoughts to our listeners on how they can follow a dream, make change in the world, you know, through their art, or even if we're not artists, you know, by supporting art or watching great art, you know, experiencing it in a film theater or in a museum. What are, like, 2 or 3 things that you would tell people that, you know, are change makers who are listening that they can do? I mean, definitely watch Josh, J-O-S-H. It's a beautiful film. I'm going to finish watching it as soon as I jump off this call. I've got my laptop open and it's queued up at the halfway mark. But what can people do to understand Pakistani culture better and to, you know, follow a dream of their own, you know?
Pakistani culture, I would definitely say, you know, seek out news sources other than CNN and Fox. Maybe read BBC once in a while.
I read the BBC and NPR.
Different news sources, I would say. Yeah, just say different news sources. And if you have Pakistani friends, you know, try and... I think, you know, somebody said something great. They said, you know, you said that too. It's like you're the average of 5 people you're around. And I also feel like your life is more diverse and you will see more diverse people and you'll be more global if the people you hang out with are global. So, you know, get uncomfortable in the sense, like, reach out to people who are not like you and try and know more about them. And that's not just for Pakistan. I think that's for the rest of the world, right?
Absolutely.
Kenyan or Somalian, Ethiopian, whoever. How to follow your dreams. I think honestly, one must take a step. You know, one must put a deadline and one must take a step. And a step can be picking up the phone and calling a mentor and meeting for tea for advice. A step can be, you know, I'm going to go and borrow 5 books in the library and read about this area of research. It's like, even if you're taking a tiny step a day, it all adds up. And I think that the only way to follow your dreams is to literally pick up your foot and take a step in that direction. Being proactive is the only way, setting the intention out there and being proactive. And then understanding that there's going to be sacrifices and compromises. Nothing comes free. And so in terms of following your dream, be very positive and be hopelessly hopeful, actually. Just be hopelessly hopeful. I mean, you know, when people just do not, like, you know, I've gone and, like, called every single Pakistani grocery in the Yellow Pages in Sacramento begging people to buy tickets for my screening, and I was crying, like, while I was doing that, because I was like, I did not think this is what being a filmmaker means. I was so upset, you know, at that particular point, because I was like, this is ridiculous. But, you know, anything, I feel like any meeting I've taken, that's another thing. Whenever someone wants to meet with you, take the time out, take their call, meet with them. You never know what is going to help you in your life, and help doesn't have to be like, it's just in forwarding you. But and then the other thing, the last thing I would say is, like, a lot of times people will help you when you're trying to follow your dreams if you find out how you can be of service to them and be genuinely interested in them. And you will realize that if your intentions are right and you're working really hard and you're reaching out to people and trying to just take advice, maybe not even ask, and try and see if you can help them, you'll notice how magically things will start gelling together and things will start moving forward.
Absolutely.
Always have, like, the best people around you. I think that there will be so many moments of doubt, so make sure you have your you know, best friends, your lovers, your cheerleaders around you, because it's very lonely.
Definitely. Well, that is all fantastic advice and so true. I mean, I definitely have had a lot of resistance to show up to certain meetings or certain places thinking, oh, I'm so busy, I can't believe I'm doing this. And then all of a sudden, like, bam, like a massive breakthrough I could have never predicted. So I do believe in the magic of showing up. And thank you for showing up, Aram, and being a change maker. I'm really excited to watch the rest of your film when I jump off this, but also to see what you're up to next. Can you just tell our audience a little bit about your next film?
Yes, absolutely. And the best way to stay in touch would be just to follow my Twitter, Aram P. Bival, or just on Facebook, just my name. My next film is a film that's a Film Independent Endorsed Writers Directors Lab film, and I'm hoping very soon to make a good announcement with it. We got into the Sundance Financiers Intensive end of April, so I'm heading to that. It's a film about Islamophobia and dance, and it's a film about, you know, a South Asian American family in Chicago, and it's about a girl who really wants to dance and is a fantastic dancer, wants to become a professional dancer. And she is the daughter of a Chicago police officer. It's about what happens in their life when their very orthodox father lands on their doorstep 10 minutes into the film from Pakistan. It talks a little bit about the identity of being Muslim in a post-9/11 world, within the Muslim community as well as without. So, and then it's visually explained through her story as a dancer.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Well, dance is so powerful. And And Aram, thank you so much. I do want our audience to know that Aram can be found. Her name is spelled I-R-U-M.
I-R-A-M.
Sorry. I wrote it to pronounce it correctly because I was nervous. I was like, I've said your name 100 times, but I know on air sometimes I say it wrong. So I-R-A-M, and the website is I-R-A-M. Can you spell it for us?
Yeah, it's I-R-A-M-P-A-R-V-E-E-N, as in Nancy, and B as in boy, I-L-A-L.com.
Great.
And you can find me on Facebook with the same
You have a name like mine. It's not easy to find, but once you find it, it's totally worth
it. There's no one else like you, right? There was a Bollywood actress who was named after me for a role.
Oh, really?
This director loved my name, so he named her my entire name. It was like all over the news in India.
What an honor. Well, it's great. Well, I am very grateful. Thank you so much for joining us. And Changemakers, go out and make your voice heard. Pick up a video camera. Do that piece of art. Paint that painting. Create change through self-expression. And just know that you aren't alone. And surround yourself with amazing people. And Aram, thank you so much. And to our changemakers, you can find out more on the Zena TV website, ZHENA.TV. I'm at Twitter at Mistress of T. I'll be tweeting Aram and all of her information and links. And on Zena TV, we will have an awesome blog listing all of the great steps that Aram mentioned in Following Your Dreams, as well as links to her films. And thank you so much for joining us. And
thank you so much. Live life one cup at a time.
Yay! Oh, and Aram's read my book. Oh, just a little plug for that, Life by the Cup. Yay! All right. Thanks, Aram.